Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Today, why more women don't make it to the corner office. Journalist Susan Shearer recently wrote a story for the New York Times in which she asked women who almost made it to CEO why they just missed the top job. This hour, I'm going to flip her premise a bit and open this up for a wider conversation. And I hope you'll join in via social media. If you're a young woman who has had her eye on a top corporate job, what kind of obstacles do you think you'll encounter? And if you're a woman who came close, give us your observations about what holds women back. Here's my Twitter feed. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Would love to hear from you during the conversation. Our roundtablers today, Janet Dolan is the president of Act 3 Consulting and the former CEO of Tenet Company. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Mary Pokluta is the founder and CEO of Bumblebee Personal Assistance. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Pleasure.
Am I pronouncing your last name right?
On point.
All right, good. And Susan Bourne is with us. She manages Spencer Stewart, an executive search firm. Great to have you here, Susan. Welcome.
Thanks,
good to have
Carrie.
You here. I think, Janet, that this is such an interesting approach. The women who spent most of their careers aspiring to have the top job and didn't make it, but have the kind of knowledge and sensibility about what they were aspiring to, and maybe more self-knowledge about why they didn't make it. What comes to mind as someone who actually did make it to the top, to the top job, about what's required?
Well, the numbers themselves point out how hard it is. I mean, fewer than 10%, probably closer to 5% of the Fortune 500 corner offices are held by women, despite the fact that there are a lot of women in the pipeline. So what comes to mind is, why is it so hard? Why did I make it and someone else didn't? And most importantly, is this going to change at anything other than the glacial speed it still seems to be at? It doesn't seem any different than when I started my climb on the corporate ladder in 1985.
Are you able to answer that question, why you made it and a lot of women don't?
I know some things, which is I made an effort when I went into corporate America to find a corporation where it had a reputation for meritocracy and egalitarianism. I mean, so first and foremost, you better pick a right place to start, because the statistics show that most of the women, at least so far, most of the women who get to the corner office have been a career at that company. It is not the jettison in from the outside. It is do the hard work. And so picking the right company to start with is one. And the second, I think, is if you don't see yourself as a woman executive, but you see yourself as an executive, you may not be able to change other people's perspective, but I think it is a lot, you're going to have a lot better opportunity.
I hear that as much of corporate culture will not see you as a leader unless they know you kind of inside out. Is that fair, or am I being a little tough?
Mm-hmm. Not so tough, Carrie. The numbers would support, I think, what you're saying, and women have to have sponsors to get ahead, and often those sponsors are earned through being at the company and going through a series of jobs, climbing up within an organization. They're great examples of women who've come in at the top and been successful, but those are people who've had sponsorship and track records at other companies and achieved some level of visibility or notoriety in one way or another.
And are those track records, if you put them up against the track records that are required of male executives, would you see that there's more required from a woman's track record?
There's more required. There are more barriers. There's just no question about it.
Mary, what about this idea of seeing yourself as an executive, not a woman executive? Janet described it that way.
You really do have to see yourself as that executive, because when you are in a room with fellow men who are the executives, you have to be one of them.
You have to be one of the men.
Yes.
Why?
They can smell it if you're not. And being one of the men allows that comfort to be able to have those conversations and relate to those things, and conversations that are going on in that circle. And I've found that learning how to drink whiskey and learning how to smoke cigars is a piece that gets me into that group to have those conversations.
Oh my gosh. I am not in no way diminishing Mary's experience with this, but Janet, what the heck?
And
right?
The reason you have a panel is to have a little variation.
Oh, well, absolutely.
I didn't feel that I had to do that. In fact, when I say see yourself as an executive, not a woman executive, I mean don't wear your gender on your sleeve. I felt that what I needed to do was be taken extremely seriously. This is a thoughtful, deep-thinking person who, when they speak, everybody listens. And that's not easy to do. You have to practice that. But I still think, and I hope Susan would support it as a recruiter, if you do a really good job, doesn't mean you're going to get it, but at least you'll be considered for it. And so to me, that's what it is you take your job very seriously. You do a very good job at every single stage. You don't look out ahead. You get each step, but you keep moving forward. And you keep saying to people, lead, follower, get out of the way. But I'm moving up. That's what I meant about having an executive attitude.
Susan, what do you think?
I think I appreciate Mary's point about being one of the boys. And I think for me and my experience, both my personally and with other women, is part of that is having the confidence that the guys have and being able to go toe-to-toe on the issues that are critical in your company, being able to joke a bit. However, I think the flip side of what Mary has said is that at least in the early years of my career, you could get in big trouble if you hobnobbed with the boys too much, traveled. Wives got very jealous. Spouses got jealous of female executives when there weren't that many. In the late 70s, I was asked to bring a note to work saying that my husband would allow me to travel with the guys.
Oh, oh my.
So,
So this is supported by something that was in Susan's article that I made a note of. Dina Dublin, who was CFO of J.P. Morgan Chase, until she retired, said that women also face the perception that if they're having drinks or dinner with a male executive and talking business, it might be seen as flirting or inappropriate. And you know what came to my mind immediately was Mike Pence, the vice president, saying he is very careful not to have meetings, particularly over meals, with women alone. Mary, how the heck are we going to change this if where we are today is still, I have to be seen not to be flirting, I have to drink whiskey and cigars with the boys? I mean, it's what that means is kind of sublimating the way you feel like you can be in that environment for a framework that the men have set, isn't it?
It is. And in whatever corporation or type of business that you're in, every environment is different, right? So that's going to depict your behavior or how you step into that organization with the specific type of confidence, right? So being able to step in that environment, maintain your confidence, and be at the level that everyone else in the room is in allows you to make those connections in those ways that otherwise you could not. And that's how I've been successful is being myself in that environment, in those conditions, always maintaining my integrity, but bringing myself to the playing field. Because then I'm viewed as I can handle the business, I can handle the environment, and I can handle the people in the room.
You know, Susan, what I thought of when you used the word confidence was also authority. And authority isn't something I don't think that you can demand. In some ways, it's kind of given to you, but it's really crucial, isn't it, to a corporate environment where you're in leadership?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You have to be seen to have the information, to be making the decisions, to have the support of your colleagues, to go forward with perhaps what may be a new strategic direction or an unpopular decision around a product line. And the authority comes from the sense that your colleagues have, that you know what you're talking about, and your own personal confidence that you've done the homework to reach that decision. And it doesn't hurt to have a sponsor, Carrie. to have someone.
Are we talking
who's
mentorship
got your
back. Here, Susan?
Yes,
specifically.
We are. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why is that so essential?
Well, we've talked about the fact that barriers simply exist for women. It's a reality. And I think having a mentor who can help you understand the cultural barriers, who can stand up for you when you're not in the room, who can take you aside and say, here's something I observed and here's a way to change that up the next time you're with this group, it's very helpful, whether that person is a man or a woman. Having somebody who's willing to help you read the culture is critical.
Do men need that kind of mentorship, Janet? Or is this something in some ways unique to women, leaders?
Well, I think women probably need it more because they are alone in most corporate environments until we get more women in other leadership roles. I think men frequently get mentoring in more informal ways. And so the challenge or the opportunity for women is to really know that you need it and go and find it and build it. And so I think that's the difference. Men and women both get mentored if they make an effort. Mm-hmm. But men, just because they frequently are doing a lot more things just informally together, they pick this up. Whereas a woman has to make more of a considered effort to go out and find it and then embrace it and use it and make it themselves successful.
You know, Mary, in some ways, this is kind of that male camaraderie that you were talking about, and the way that mentorship or sponsorship kind of informally works into that, right? Being in a group with men, some of who may be higher up in the company, and you're picking up cues and getting advice and learning in those environments that women may not have access to.
Absolutely. And that's why I do that. That's where I get to learn and watch and observe and just really be a sponge and soak in interactions, soak in how the older men will mentor the younger men without them even knowing.
Yeah, right.
That's why I've chosen to be a part of that, because I'm able to learn that aspect and then apply that to myself and then also pass it along to the people that I mentor. And then it just becomes another level that we get raised up because we're able to take that knowledge in and use it.
What's the hardest leadership lesson you've had to learn in any of the companies that you've been in?
I'd say trust.
How so?
When you're being mentored, when you have management above you, you trust them to guide you and you trust them to set you on the right course, right? And sometimes with all the learning lessons that come, that course may not have been the best course for you. So you have to backpedal, realign, and then move forward. And then so the next time you come to that opportunity, the trust piece is there on, oh, been here, done that, do I do it? And every single time, I trust, and it goes well. But there's also those times that you get taken off track, and those are the lessons that build you up for what you need to be able to manage in the future. And
Janet, what do you hear in that?
Well, I hear that she's perhaps had some circumstances where she felt she placed her trust and it wasn't reciprocated or it wasn't rewarded. But I think the core of what she's saying is keep moving forward. Keep moving forward. I would answer that in terms of the thing I learned is take risks. And I think that is one of the biggest stumbling blocks to women, is learn to take risks and move forward. And the other thing I think is see yourself in that next position, because the fact that she doesn't have role models means you're going to have to be the role model for the people behind you. So if you see yourself in that position. And the final one, I think, is don't assume that your gender is going to keep you back. There are a lot of wonderful, good men in corporations. And as Susan said, find a sponsor who believes having the best people in every box on that organization chart is important for the company. Because there's a lot of them that don't, and you're not going to change them. But find the ones who believe in performance and get them to be there in that room when you're not, saying, no, but she's doing a great job, you know. So anyway, I don't let early stumbles because of other people not being supportive hold you back. Just see yourself in that spot and then go for it.
Susan, most powerful and maybe toughest leadership lesson you had to learn mm-hmm. on your way up.
Mm-hmm. I think for me it was that doing a great job as an individual isn't enough, that you really have to have a team around you who believes in you and supports you, and that if you've got that, if you have that group of people pushing ideas and pushing you forward, you're much more likely to gain the success that you're looking for.
How long had you been in the corporate culture before you understood that?
It was probably really 10 years before I had a management role that was of a size where I could really leverage a team and where I could make some big mistakes, which is what you need to do whether you're a man or a woman. You really have to, you've learned these lessons, as you've asked, Carrie, by screwing up. And so for me, really understanding the power of leading a team as opposed to being an individual performer was critical.
Janet said taking risks is something that maybe women fear more to do because maybe the stakes seem higher. Is that right, Janet?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The stakes seem higher because failing feels more devastating?
Well, I think, without getting too much into gender stereotypes, we are, as young women and women in society, we are encouraged to be careful. I mean, the messages we get as children,
yeah.
Don't go up the slide because you might fall off the slide. And if a young man goes up, go for it. That takes a long time to get out of that mode of be careful, be watchful. You know, you're at risk in our society. And that's lethal in a business context. If you're not willing to, as Susan said, take risks and fail, learn from them, and then be a better executive as a result of it, you won't make it.
But I really understand that because it does seem like there's more at stake. And failure, if there's fewer spots that the most successful women can get, failure seems like it would have even more dire consequences than it does for men who have much more opportunity. Mm-hmm. Susan?
You know, Carrie, as a recruiter, what I heard from many clients and particularly boards looking for CEOs was that women hadn't taken the risk to take on the tough assignments.
Interesting.
To take on an operating role or to take on an international role. And when you peel back the onion on that, I think one of, and again, we're coming back to a gender issue, but for a woman who's seeking a high-level career and also building a family, to take an international assignment or to move the family, even if it's just across the U.S., is a very big and risky decision. And part of the shtick that for many years we heard was that there weren't enough women in the pipeline because women wouldn't take those roles on. I frankly think that's old news, and I think we have to get beyond that to say there are women who have the ability to take these jobs, and you just have to look broadly and be a little bit more open about the kinds of experiences that prepare you.
So what I'm curious about is when one of your clients would say that, I want a woman who's a risk taker, and as I look at these resumes that you've given me, Susan, I don't see enough women taking those kinds of risks. What would your answer be back to that?
You have to go very personally to the individual that you're putting forward,
okay,
and be able to demonstrate that that individual has taken risks that may not look exactly like what they're accustomed
Got
to seeing.
Got it.
But in her own life, she has put herself way out there to be where she is, and at the same time has raised a great family and has kids and a husband. You know, the issue is always to see if you can change the lens in the conversation, because everyone looks from their personal lens. And so often the hiring entities at the tops of companies are men.
Right. So what you were trying to do was reframe the idea of what risk is.
Yes.
To the person who's doing the hiring. How does that look for you, Mary?
Risk is my middle name.
How so?
I would not be this far if I hadn't risked. There was a lot of opportunities presented to me that were terrifying. And I said yes. And everyone around me looked at me like I was out of my mind. And
can you give me one example? Because I sense you're thinking
absolutely.
Of one specifically. Good.
I was asked to have our company be on site at a local Fortune 500 here in the Twin Cities, not having ever done it before, not having no idea what it took. I said yes, and I figured it out. And that year was like going through a college education, 4 years of college education in 1 year, and coming out the other end, I now can go into any Fortune 500 because I did that. Was it terrifying? Absolutely. Did it almost break us? Absolutely. But it also allowed us to leap 5 levels up. I've also had other risks that didn't work out and learned from those. So I apply those failures to future endeavors to make sure I don't make the same mistake.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable that was sparked by an article that Susan Chira wrote for the New York Times. And it's a piece of, with interviews from women who almost made it to CEO. They made it high up on the chain. They didn't quite get the top job. Many of these women wanted it. And I wanted to take that piece and ask some women who have been in the corporate culture to say, what do you take from the insights of these women that almost made it? What should we understand about corporate culture today? And as you listen to this conversation, I'm asking you, if you're a younger woman who has her eye on a top corporate job, what kinds of obstacles do you think you'll encounter? I mean, what are you picking up even now that's telling you about your ambitions to make it to the top of the company? And if you're a woman who came close or you made it to the top, give us your observations about what holds women back and maybe what more women should understand. Because let's be honest, the number of women, as we started out saying, is very small who are in these top CEO jobs. So talk to me about this on Twitter. It's at Kerri, KerriMPR. This is probably a good place to get a news break in. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. The State Department says at least one American was killed and one was injured in the terrorist attacks in Barcelona and Cambrils, Spain. The department did not identify either of the Americans, but said the injured person suffered only a minor wound. Tourists and Barcelona residents have tentatively returned to Las Ramblas for a subdued stroll a day after a van attack killed 13 people and injured more than 100. Dozens of armed police officers in blue and neon yellow uniforms were stationed near Plaça de Catalunya, and the street was still closed to vehicles. In nearby Cambrils, the vehicle drove down a beachside promenade, hitting several people. Police say 5 people in the vehicle were shot and killed by police. Police in Finland say they are looking for more potential suspects in the stabbing of several people in the western city of Turku. Police say they shot one man in the leg who was suspected of stabbing several others. A news report says 6 people were injured, 1 man and 5 women, and a woman with a stroller was attacked by a man with a large knife. The Pentagon says Defense Secretary Jim Mattis will visit Ukraine next week to reassure government leaders there the U.S. does not accept Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region. The visit comes as the Trump administration considers giving Ukraine lethal weaponry. And a statue of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice who wrote the 1857 Dred Scott decision that upheld slavery was removed from the grounds of the Maryland State House early this morning. The statue of Roger Taney will be placed in storage. Memorials to the Confederacy have been coming down across the nation since last week's racial violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:30.
Increase the impact of your sustaining membership by switching to an automatic deduction through your checking account. It eliminates credit card fees so more of your gift can power the radio you love. Switch today at npr.org/checking.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up next hour on NPR News, join Andrea Swenson from The Current and me for our next interview in the Summer Music Series. We'll visit with rapper 2 for 1. Join us then.
Programming is supported in part by our members and by the General Mills Foundation, strengthening communities around the globe through philanthropy and employee volunteerism. Programming is supported by the Minnesota State Fair, presenting the Minnesota Show with Garrison Keillor, Friday, September 1st at the Grandstand. Tickets available now at mnstatefair.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable about why more women don't make it to the corner office, and I want to give all credit to Susan Chira of the New York Times because she wrote about this and did a number of interviews with women who made it to number two or high up on the executive rung but didn't quite make it to the top. And so I'm talking with three women today who have a lot of different experience and bring different experiences to this conversation. Janet Dolan with us, the president of Act Three Consulting, former CEO of Tenet Company. Susan Boren, a retired partner at Spencer Stewart, an executive search firm, so I have to correct that. And Mary Pokluta, founder and CEO of Bumblebee Personal Assistance. Janet, you want to talk about boards.
I do.
Why?
The reason I want to talk about boards is because that is where the decision is made. We've talked a lot in the so far about inside the company,
right,
working your way up. But the ultimate decision gets made in the board. And I wear two hats because I was a CEO, but I also sit on corporate boards where I'm in the room where they make that decision. So it's exceedingly important to think about the number of women who are on boards. And while the percentage of women on boards in the United States is about 20%, so it's four times as much as the number of women in the CEO office, it's still less than half. And there's been a lot of research that women who seek and are considered for the CEO position are more likely to get it if there are women on the board, but and particularly more than one. More than one woman. So so it's really important to also focus on getting women on boards so that they are a voice in the making of the decision.
Can I ask you what, from your experience then of sitting on boards,
yes,
and being faced with a decision like this, and maybe one of the candidates for CEO is a woman, how that discussion goes and what little cues you pick up from those conversations?
Well, first of all, because there are so few women that make it to the corner office, usually there are no women in the final two or three because it has frequently been a path within.
Mm-hmm.
Or the company has chosen to go outside and bring in, and that's even less frequently a woman. I think Susan might address that. So the first discussion is why aren't there more women in the mix? And then ultimately, why would we not select the woman?
Why aren't there more women on boards, Susan?
Well, as a board recruiter, my experience was, Carrie, that most clients start a search for a new board of director saying we want a diverse group of candidates. And so it's incumbent upon the search consultant to bring forth a group of diverse candidates,
uh-huh,
which I was always inclined to do. And then over time, the discussion revolves around fit. Culture of the boardroom, which is most often primarily men and oftentimes just primarily white men. And so to bring a diverse candidate, whether that's an ethnic minority or a woman, they have to be better. They have to have achieved something even greater to make it through what is almost I hesitate to use the word hazing, but it is, you know, the conversation that you are privy to as a recruiter is,
mm-hmm,
interesting to see how someone can be eliminated based on biases.
I mean, what I kind of hear you saying is there's coded language and you really understand what's beneath the code. When they,
yeah,
talk about fit, you know,
yeah,
what that means.
Yeah, you learn, of course, and this is not something that happens in every boardroom, but if you look at the number of women on boards, you can see, as Janet said, 20 boards are made up 20% of women. The companies run by women, that percentage is 30%. So there's something different going,
yeah,
on there.
All right, Mary?
So I feel whether it's intentional or not that nepotism is the reason why a lot of boards are not diverse.
Meaning?
So we all know, we all have our group of colleagues, friends, mentors, and people that we work with on a daily basis, right? So when anyone says, I'm looking for someone for this, we're going to pull from the pool that we are surrounded by, right? And if your group is not diverse or your group doesn't have different dynamics, the same type of person is going to be the people that are going to be filling those seats, right? So the boards that I sit on, I dig into the communities that we want the people to have the seats on the board to fill those positions so that I get diversity on those boards. Because any board position that I've had to seek out and find and ask and get. I've not been approached. Suck it out to get it. And so then they are thrilled because diversity steps on. And then with that, I pull from diversity that I know. And then there it is. But these are young boards. They're not corporate boards, which we're discussing today. But from the amount of time that I've been sitting on boards, that's the experience that I've seen, and that's the conclusion that I've come to.
This really makes a lot of sense, right? If your pool looks like this and everybody feels comfortable with the fit of the people in the pool, it's going to feel dissonant to go outside of that and bring somebody into that group.
Well, as a board member, I would like corporate boards. I would like to say that old boys club of how do you find board members, which is who do you know, at least in larger corporations, is changing significantly. It is through some of the corporate regulations and changes in the last 10 years, Sarbanes-Oxley and the New York Stock Exchange, and just the pressure of and focus of activist shareholders on who sits on the board. More of the larger boards, at least, are looking to the Spencer Stewarts of the world to do a thorough search and to bring board members in. So there's less of that in the bigger companies. But one thing I found this weekend as I was preparing for your show was quite startling is this, Kate, the situation of are women held to a higher standard? And the tenure of women CEOs, in other words, the ones who do get there, mm-hmm. is 2/3 of that of men. Men's tenure, according to like the 2016 study, the tenure for men is about 6 years as CEO, and the tenure for women is 4. So you can draw some conclusions, which is they may be held to a higher standard. The other thing is, I think sitting in boardrooms, looking at naming the first woman CEO, will be seen as a higher risk decision, and therefore I think there might be a higher the first time there's perhaps a misstep, it might be, early indication we made a bad decision here, we better change course, as opposed to men, which it might be, well, they just have to kind of learn the job. So I do think even once you get there, there still may be this, it's mm-hmm. going to be tougher, even once you get the job, to be successful in the job, because I think the filter might still be different.
So, Mary, do you think that may be what is part of the reason for that difference in the average tenure between men and women as CEOs?
It's not the filter. It's the microscope you're under.
Meaning?
That you are watched very carefully. Everyone is paying attention to your every move. So that puts, in sitting in that position, knowing that you're being watched and knowing that, you know, every move you make has got to be perfect, or they're going to chalk it up to, well, that's what we thought or that's what we expected. So it's a lot of stress and it's a lot of pressure going into that. But going back to what I said in the beginning, if you maintain your focus and you have your eye on the prize and you climb that hill knowing that that's what you want, you're going to attain it. And hopefully break some glass ceilings.
You know, you've also made me think about how, as an individual and as somebody who's on a path to leadership, it is important to understand what failure means to you and to know how to talk about it publicly, right, or within the company.
Absolutely.
That probably makes a lot of women uncomfortable.
It does. But that's what my mentors taught me, and my mentors were women. that are successful and broke those glass ceilings and made the path for me to be able to follow in a sense until I veered off, because there is no one on my path to follow. I'm making the path.
You are right? Now?
Yes.
How so?
So in starting my company, there wasn't anything really like it here. And the way I have come to evolve, I'm still the only type of company that's like that here in the Twin Cities. So it was a path that I had to pave on my own in certain circumstances. I had mentorship with business and mentorship with leadership and mentorship with all of those different qualities that I needed to learn. But I really had no one to see and emulate on this journey. So it was really trial and error and paving that way. So now I'm mentoring people who are doing the similar things as I am in different parts of the United States and even here in the Twin Cities.
Oh. You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's about women and leadership, and drawn from an article that Susan Chira wrote for the New York Times. And I'll tweet out a link on that. How it is that so few women still make it to the top, what women who have come close to making it say about that, and the insights from our group of roundtablers who bring a lot of different kinds of experiences to this. Susan, I was reading some, and I'm coming back to you because you were talking about teamwork. I was reading some research from a corporate culture anthropologist. I thought this was interesting. And she said that when she asked both men and women about the culture that they preferred within their companies, they said the clan culture, the one that emphasizes collaboration and teamwork and a focus on people. And yet this anthropologist asks, if that is indeed true, and women often bring that kind of or create a culture like that in a company or in a place where they can be influential, it is sometimes perceived as being a problem, that is the way that women most like to lead, or a softer way to lead, or not as authoritative. How do we reckon with that?
It's difficult to reconcile, because I think oftentimes the criticism of female leaders as they're being looked at for more senior roles, and particularly for that CEO or corner office role, is that they're not strong enough,
right,
or that they lead with softer skills. And again, we're coming back to some innate biases that are very hard to overcome, because so often it is those collaborative skills, those people leadership skills, that have made those women quite successful in their rise to the top. But they get judged for them at the end of the day.
Janet?
Well, I think Susan is right. First of all, if you're going to move up, you have to have good team building and team leadership skills, because no one can do it by themselves. But on the other hand, even clans have leaders. So while you're working through everyone in the clan, that clan is still figuring out who they're going to elect to lead them. So you have to be able to do both. And so often the criticism is you're good at working through others, but are you decisive? Can you make a decision and move on and not circle back and second guess yourself? I mean, there's just certain attributes that the leader has, and there's certain attributes that working well with others have, and you just have to bring them both together.
For me, setting the expectation is key. Born and raised in Texas, I don't do the Minnesota nice very well. And so I have to preface when I'm with a group of people stating that I make eye contact. I'm very direct. I don't fluff things. And once I learned that I had to set that tone for myself personally, I wasn't misunderstood as much. Because there's sometimes I can say something very direct with just the right amount of eye contact, and then I realize, ooh, that's coming off very strong. But it's the passion. It's the
right
passion that's making that, oh my gosh, can you imagine if we do this? And then I freak people out. And
I would think that would be inspiring, Mary. I don't know why that freaks people out.
Hang out with me for 10 minutes and you'll realize why that's an issue. But I think setting the expectation, also standing your ground. Women get judged immensely on speaking their mind, making a strong, bold statement, or even standing up for what they feel is right. And so being able to do that with confidence and standing there doing it, even though you feel like wavering and you want to buckle, once you prove that piece, then you get that respect as the leader. But also when you make a mistake, ask for feedback. I'm constantly asking for constructive criticism and feedback. If you feel there's a better way that I can do this, if you see somewhere where I can make an improvement, please tell me.
That's great. You do that as the CEO?
Ask everyone, yes.
Wow.
And people will come to me because it allows them to step into that uncomfortable position to tell their boss, hey, you know what? I think we can do this a little bit better.
Right.
Then I take the step back and say, oh my gosh, I completely agree. Let's try to implement that. Let's work on that, on how we can implement it. I mean, there's been so many ways that the company has been improved by allowing people to do that. Mm-hmm. And I will continue to do so as long as I live, because I've been able to learn and I've been able to pivot and adjust based on other people seeing from a different perspective, which we've talked about here today.
This is something, Susan, I don't know if you've ever heard Bill George talk about this, or Janet, which I doubted him until he's said this several times, that he really, as the CEO of Medtronic, would say, tell me where I'm screwing up, where I'm not getting it right. And it took a while, but people took the opportunity like they did with Mary. Maybe that's the kind of leadership everybody wants, whether man or woman leading the company. Why is there more of that?
And Bill would say this if he were in this conversation. It takes a long time to get to the level of experience that allows you to be that vulnerable.
Okay.
And I think that vulnerability is very attractive in strong leaders, but to get there, you have to pass through some cycles of your growth. And but
what are you really saying? It's not the kind of thing you can do the first year as CEO. Most of us would not have the confidence or...
I don't mean to imply that. I'm just saying that part of what you learn as a leader is to become more vulnerable, to share more of your own foibles with your people, to be able to say, I really don't want to do this alone. I want us to do this together. And so help me with your feedback.
And I would say it comes from inside. If you respect the fact that your team members, from whether it's the person who is the receptionist or your senior vice president, if you respect the fact that every member of your team wants to do well by the company, and if you look at them and you ask them for their opinion, and they look at you and they think, this person really cares. This person's going to listen to what I have to say. Mm-hmm. May not agree, but it goes back to what Mary mentioned, trust. And boy, I think you better have it long before you get that first year of CEO. You better have gotten it on the way up, which is, we are all here for one common goal, and that is to make this place a better place. And there's no shortage of good ideas out there. People will see through immediately if they've got a cocky executive who doesn't really care and just thinks it's all about the perks of the office. Or if they've got somebody who doesn't care what your title is, they care what your opinion is. And you know something about what they're asking about, or they wouldn't be asking you.
How come if people see through the cocky, it's all about the perks and the pay of the office, so many CEOs like that end up at the top of companies? Most of them not women, by the way.
I think that... First of all, I think that stereotype is overused. I've known a lot of corporate executives, and they are very serious people. There could be a really good woman and probably should have been. So I'm not saying that there shouldn't. But I find, in my experience, most of the really incompetent, but I'm just going to get by on my smile and my cockiness, they do get weeded out before.
Okay, maybe not incompetent, but there's lots of – it seems to me there's plenty of competent – and cocky, and it's really about the stock options that I'm taking out of here. People leading companies.
There are some high visibility ones, and they get a certain
arrogance that comes from the isolation. My great mentor, Roger Hale, used to say, if you live in a glass office and you take a glass and you take an elevator up to your office and you eat in the corporate dining room and you park in a, you know, or have a chauffeur driven limousine, of course you're not going to relate to the people. So some people, you know, create that isolation, but I do not think that is all or even most CEOs.
Susan has a rather enigmatic smile on her face about this.
Gary, I think you've asked the question of this hour, mm-hmm. really, because given all we know and all we've learned and the value we place on equality and diversity, why are we still here? Why do the numbers belie the fact that we understand that women can be as great or greater leaders than men? And I don't personally have an answer to that. I just want to keep trying to solve for it.
One of the things that you came to the roundtable with was this acknowledgement that corporations are not the only place where we're seeing this happening. And I think you were saying you read a piece in the Times about this.
There was a very thought-provoking piece, the title of which was The Moms Who Keep the World Safe. And the gist of that piece was, just as Susan's piece was on the corporate world, that if you look at the people who run the intelligence in our government and globally, you'll see an underrepresentation of women in those senior roles as well, whether they are the operators of our agencies or the people doing policy work around government and defense. And we see the same thing in the not-for-profit sector. I can't think of an area of our lives where this discussion isn't relevant.
So, Mary, Susan said, and I want to solve for it. What are some of the solutions? It sounds to me like, as you talked about the people that you're mentoring in a rather unexpected path, like the one that you had, you're doing some of that. What else?
I feel that supporting other women is a huge, huge, huge aspect to this. There are so many women out there that need that support, that need that strong foundation, that just need the encouragement of you can do it. I had a lot of people that didn't believe that I was going to be successful because I had no experience with entrepreneurship at all in my life. And it comes to that risk thing. Not everyone takes risks. Risks are hard. Risks are unpredictable. If you can cross that first hurdle, then the next hurdle is the support system as you rise. And then that support system going to that next level, because there are times where the mentee surpasses the mentor. And sometimes it's a spectacular experience, and sometimes it's not a spectacular experience. And then once you get to that top, one of my mentors, during a really tough time for me, I looked into her eyes, and she goes, "What's wrong?" And I said, she goes, "Are you alone?" And I said, "Absolutely." And she goes, "Well, it's lonely at the top."
And do you still feel that?
Not as much anymore. Because I have surrounded myself with the type of people that support, mentor, and also help lift me up in the different positions and things that I do. But there was a time where I felt I was alone. And when she told me that, I looked around and realized, oh my gosh, I've made it. And I didn't realize that. It took her telling me that for me to realize I made it. And from there, I had to figure out, where do I go? And once I did, then now I was able to place the people I needed in my life in the capacity that I needed through the next levels as I go. And I'm going to continue to do that because I cannot do it alone. You know, it's a hive mentality. Everyone has
at the
to work together.
Company.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a hive mentality. The queen can't do anything without her bees.
That's great.
Would you two say something about loneliness? What, Janet? What comes to mind?
I didn't find it that lonely, But I'm an extrovert. I mean, I really reached out to other, at whatever level I was at, I reached out to other people, largely in this community, who were in the same position. So I always formed a network. So I didn't find it that lonely, except I will say the day the board named me CEO and I walked in and sat in that chair, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm alone. But anyway, that was the only time. Yeah, that was the only time. But you had asked what we can do about this. And so I gave some thought to that. And I've kind of a three-step. Early on, we have to raise daughters to see themselves as leaders. So don't tell them not to take risks. Push them to take risks. You know, middle couples who both have careers, you have to early on seriously think about childcare, because in the Western world, particularly in the United States, it is the childcare issue that is one of the biggest barriers.
And the expense of it. Right.
And then at the other end, I think we just have to get more women on boards, not just because they'll make the CEO decision, but they'll ask, why is this division manager not a woman? Why? So they'll have more influence on getting more people into the final decision.
And thinking differently about it. Susan, loneliness or what we can do about it? Take your pick.
I think the reality today for young women looking at jobs at the top is it's a long road to loneliness. And those top jobs are inevitably lonely unless, as Janet says, you begin to think about how you solve for that as an individual, bringing your team into the equation, bringing mentors, seeking outsiders. But there's no question that if you aspire to a top job in a company, in government, in politics, you better be ready to be standing alone at certain points in your career. And I think to Mary's point, she took the risk to do that. To solve for it, I think Janet's articulated three really great things. The thing I would add to that is that working with the men who are still in the position to make these decisions and reminding them of their daughters and the commitment they have to their wives and the other women in their life helps them to look, step back and say, I see how that works here in this organization and I need to help.
Well, we had to solve for some very busy schedules, so I'm really glad that the three of you finally came into the studio together and did this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks,
good to
Carrie.
Have you here.